I've had a lot of coffee, and this one stands out. It's called Larry's Coffee. It has this really cute vibe to it, first of all. I've been drinking it in the mornings, and it's noticeably smoother. My favorite blend is Bean Martin. It just tasted so good. I immediately went and got a second cup of coffee. I just love the rich, dark flavor. It's got a little cartoon character on the bag, and he is drinking coffee, and he also has a martini because it's probably an espresso martini because, you know, he's Bean Martin. They have light, medium, dark roast, espresso, decaf. Larry's Coffee is independent, family-owned and operated, roasted in Raleigh, North Carolina for over 30 years. You can try this wonderful coffee and support the BGS Podcast Network at larryscoffee.com/BGS. Listeners of the BGS Podcast Network get a free gift with purchase when they purchase through that show link. And again, that's larryscoffee.com/BGS. Thanks for listening to the BGS Podcast Network. If you're interested in diving deeper into the world of roots music, Americana, and beyond, be sure to explore more from The Bluegrass Situation. Visit thebluegrasssituation.com to browse the latest editorials. And don't forget to subscribe to our weekly newsletter for new releases, exclusive content, video sessions, and more delivered straight to your inbox. Sign up at thebluegrasssituation.com/newsletter.
Welcome to The Working Songwriter, the show where today's best songwriters come to talk shop. I'm your host, Joe Pug. Each episode here, we host a distinguished guest, and we ask them to go deep on their inspiration, on their process, on the general ups and downs of making a life in music. So, whether you're a grizzled veteran using ChatGPT to write children's songs and then uploading them to Spotify in batches by the thousands, or else a scrappy upstart, using your own brain and heart to create music because that is somehow vintage now, this is your show. Because ultimately, it is what every writer seeks most, an ironclad excuse to put off actually writing. Hey everyone, thanks for being here. This week's show is brought to you by Bandzoogle. Built by musicians and for musicians, Bandzoogle is an all-in-one platform to build a beautiful website for your music. I'm old enough to remember when you had to pay somebody called a web developer to get a website made. It would always be some guy named Ronnie who drove a 2007 Toyota 4Runner with window tint that was patently illegal and who's always trying to sell you nitrous oxide hits from a tank in his trunk. And old Ronnie would charge you about $1,000 for a website that would be obsolete in 6 months. But it's the future now. You guys, that's not how it works anymore. We're allowed to have nice things now. One of those nice things is Bandzoogle. For over 20 years, Bandzoogle has made it easy to build a stunning website and online store for your music. Now they've added a brand new EPK plan so that musicians can create a professional single-page electronic press kit in minutes. All the features you need are already built in. Music players, images, text bio, video embeds, a gig calendar, and access to Bandzoogle's award-winning support team 7 days a week. The new EPK plan starts at just $6.95 per month, and the Working Songwriter podcast listeners can go to Bandzoogle.com to try it for free for 30 days. Then use the promo code TWSEPK to get 10% off the first year of any new EPK plan subscription. That's Bandzoogle.com, promo code TWSEPK. Finally, if you enjoyed this podcast, if you'd like to help it remain a viable endeavor for me, here's a couple things that you could do to help. First and foremost, you could become a subscriber to The Vault. What is The Vault? The Vault is a private, members-only section of my website that hosts every single episode of The Working Songwriter ever recorded. Additionally, The Vault has every album I've ever recorded for streaming and for download. Not all of them are on Spotify. There's also an archive of the iconic Enthusiast Digest newsletter there. Go to joepugmusic.com/vault, become a subscriber today. It's about the price of a nice cup of coffee every month. So would you consider supporting the show and for your generosity receiving access to all that content. If you're not in a place where you can contribute in that way, it's totally cool. There's still a few ways, though, that you could help us out for free. First, you could leave us a rating in the iTunes store, or second, you could simply tell a friend about the show. The simple math on those two things is that they will help me much more than they will be a pain in the ass for you. Okay, I'll end all the harassment there. I hope that you enjoy this week's episode. Our guests this week are Gabe Dixon and Mike Madison of the Tedeschi Trucks Band, the Grammy-winning roots ensemble led by Susan Tedeschi and Derek Trucks. Formed in 2010, their debut album, Revelator, won the Grammy Award for Best Blues Album, and the group has since become one of the country's premier live bands, selling out Madison Square Garden and playing more than 20 shows at Red Rocks. Mike Madison has been working with Derek Trucks for more than two decades. He joined the Derek Trucks Band as lead vocalist in the early 2000s and became a founding member of the Tedeschi Trucks Band. He is also one of the group's principal lyricists and co-wrote one of its best-known songs, Midnight in Harlem. Keyboardist, singer, and songwriter Gabe Dixon joined the Tedeschi Trucks Band in 2019. Before that, he led the Gabe Dixon Band and built a solo career of his own. Within Tedeschi Trucks, Dixon has become a key songwriter, vocalist, and instrumentalist. The band has appeared on Austin City Limits, The Late Show with Stephen Colbert, and Jimmy Kimmel Live. NPR called the band a deeply skilled and spirited ensemble, while Rolling Stone has praised its freewheeling, soulful sound. I got a chance to catch up with Gabe and Mike to hear about their musical journey so far. Gabe Dixon and Mike Madison of the Tedeschi Trucks Band, thanks so much for being a part of the Working Songwriter podcast. Before we can get to the band that we're here to cover today, there's a lot of ground we got to cover first, because both of you have such rich musical histories before you even reach this project. Mike, you grew up in Minneapolis, which is quietly like a very, very deep music town. What do you remember about growing up there? What kind of music were you influenced by at that time?
It is an interesting music town. You know, my dad was a Lutheran minister, and he confirmed all four members of the Trashmen, who had the first number one Minnesota hit with Surfin' Bird. So that was kind of my intro. We had that 45 floating around the house. But growing up, you know, everybody was really listening to Prince, and he kind of defined what Minneapolis was about at the time. But there was a great underground scene with the Replacements and Husker Du and stuff like that. So for me, my real entree into popular music was kind of funk and punk.
Funk and punk. Yeah, that's a classic combination right there, of course. And then you would go east for school. You went to Harvard for a while. Did you study music there at Harvard?
No, I didn't. I studied American literature.
Really?
Yeah.
And were you thinking of going in that direction as a career originally?
I don't know. It was just stuff I was interested in. Music was always part of what I did. You know, I was in bands and stuff back in Minneapolis. And I always kept that with me, kind of in my pocket. But I wanted to be a writer and a journalist, and I was lucky enough to be able to do that. But I always maintained the music thing.
When did that fork in the road happen for you? When did you go from journalist to saying, hey, I might be able to do this for a living on the road playing tunes?
You know, I moved to New York City when it was still a real music town back in the 90s with my partner, Paul Olson, and our band. And we were kind of making a go of it there. And that's when I ran into Derek Trucks, and that kind of took me into music full time.
You know, it's funny that you'd say when New York used to be a real music town, because I've definitely noticed in the last decade, maybe decade and a half, pretty much all the polarity has gone to Los Angeles and Nashville. And New York just doesn't seem the same the way that it was in, let's say, 1995 or even 2000.
I think you're right. I mean, I think the music business has kind of eked out of New York, but the music itself is still here. and the venues and the energy and the players. But this was kind of the place to go if you were a hick from Minnesota and you wanted to make it the big city.
Yeah, fair enough. Fair enough. So you were playing with the band that brought you there to New York was Scrap-O-Matic, and you guys were making a real go of it, and you were signed to Alligator, I believe, which is, you know, one of the foremost blues records, record labels in America. How did this confluence come with you and Derek Trucks? I think I've read before that you guys met by happenstance almost.
We did. Well, Scrap-O-Matic wasn't signed to Alligator. We were signed to a smaller label called Landslide, which we still do stuff for. But I ran into Derek on the subway after a couple people had recommended me to him, and we had a nice chat. I didn't really know who he was. He recognized me because I had big hair, and he had seen my picture. And musically, we happened to hit it off, and we kind of took it from there.
When did it become clear that project was going to take kind of precedence over the other work that you've been doing?
He offered me a job.
cash on the barrel head.
It was a lot less than I was making, but I left my nerd job for the cool job.
Fair enough. And what did you start to learn once you became, that's a question for when we bring the confluence together for you and Gabe. Gabe, you're originally from Shelbyville, Tennessee, is that correct?
That's where I was born. Yeah, my parents are from there. My grandparents were all there. I went back there every year, a couple times a year to visit. But I really grew up in Nashville.
Oh, fair enough. Yeah.
From age 5 to 18.
Wow. Okay. That your early story starts to make a lot more sense to me here, because you really hit the ground running at a fairly young age. The Gabe Dixon Band was started in late 90s, and you were going at that time. And what was the music that you found in Nashville early on that kind of first opened your heart?
I mean, Nashville was an interesting place to grow up for a musician. They had, because it was such a rich community. And I was actually, even before I started the Gabe Dixon Band in college in Miami, I was in a strangely, I was in a teen country boy band when I was like 12 years old. I just wanted to, you know, because I was like, I was 12 and I learned how to play like Great Balls of Fire and like Elton John and like Beatles stuff to play and sing it. And I was also a classical pianist. So my mom's like, what do I do with this? And she called, there was an ad for this band that was holding auditions that was going to get signed to Curb Records and all this stuff. And so I won this, I got a slot as the keyboard player and singer. So I was exposed to Nashville's music, songwriting, and studio musician scene early on because some of the musicians played on those records. So I kind of, and we did this sort of weird country thing from about 12 till 17. And that's sort of, I didn't love the music, but it kind of gave me the bug for performing and starting to write. And so when I was in college in Miami, I put together my own band, and it was a mixture of, you know, soul and pop and rock and jazz. Like, my whole band were in the jazz school there. So, you know, there were a lot of influences that came together when I started that.
That sounds like you almost went to graduate school from age 12 to 17 for performing and recording music. What were some of the lessons that you learned at that age from those older musicians that were session players?
Well, I watched this guy, David Briggs, who was kind of a legend, and he played in, you know, Elvis's band. And he played in the Muscle Shoals band back in the 60s. And I learned the Nashville number system, like chord charts. And I just learned I would sit there in the piano booth and watch him play with all these other Nashville dudes and like just take a song from a crappy little demo to a full-fledged like Nashville sound kind of recording, you know. And I don't know. I think I learned how to sing in the studio too, because you know, at that time it was the early 90s and mid 90s, so like there was no Pro Tools or anything, so I had to get the emotion and the sort of get the pitch and everything. Or it wasn't done, you know, until I got all that right. And I just, we got a lot of songs pitched to us too. So I kind of saw that process happen early on.
When did songwriting become a part of your own process?
I started writing, I wrote my first song about 15 or so. And then I started co-writing with my mom.
Nice.
Because I had in mind, I loved Elton John, and there was this lyric, you know, he had Bernie Taupin and as the lyricist, and Elton was sort of the piano player. So for a little while, I thought, well, that'll be, I'll do that. And so my mom would just write sets of lyrics, and I'd put them to music, you know. And then eventually I started writing my own lyrics and stuff, and really started writing a lot when I was about 20.
That's a beautiful thing, because most people at 15, 16 years old are rebelling against the folks and wanting to get the hell out of the house, and you had an Elton John, Bernie Taupin kind of relationship instead with your mom.
Yeah, it's a little unusual, I guess. They had a good record collection, you know. They were listening to great stuff from the late 60s and early 70s that they grew up on, and I kind of fell in love with it too, all the singer-songwriters from that era and great bands, Joe Cocker and Allman Brothers Band, and, you know, James Taylor and folks like that.
Well, it wasn't long before your talent was recognized on a very high level, because after you had started the Gabe Dixon Band down there in, I believe, Miami, you went on the road to play keyboards and sing with Paul McCartney in 2001, 2002. How did that come together, and what was that experience like at such a young age?
It was strange because, you know, I was recording my band in this studio in L.A. with David Kahn producing, and David was producing Paul McCartney's album the next month, so he asked me to be the keyboard player. It was, when I first met him, it was like meeting a cartoon character, honestly, because I came from the Beatles place. Like, I was such a huge fan, you know. We were always playing it around the house when I was a kid. My mom, when she was a teenager, got kicked out of a movie theater for screaming too loud at A Hard Day's Night. So it's like, it was a wonderful experience getting to watch him be creative and, you know, make recordings. I was in a studio with him for 6 weeks, you know, in Los Angeles, and then did a couple shows with him, did the concert for New York City. Once I got past the overwhelm, I really enjoyed working with him and watching how, like, the simplicity of his process, you know, kind of, he seemed to be very in touch with his creative flow, when we were working. And I think it was, it probably was eye-opening for me at the time.
You know, one of the things I find the most interesting, I'm a big baseball fan, and obviously anyone who makes it to the show, to the big leagues, it was the best of the best wherever they came from. But then within the MLB, there's still stars within that, and they jump above. There's still an Aaron Judge. There's still a Mike Trout, a Shohei Ohtani. You had worked with all these very high-level guys in Nashville, so you'd been to the show, and now you're with Paul McCartney, and that strikes me as a similar thing. When you worked with him in the studio there, did you notice parts about his creative process that did levitate above even that already high level?
I mean, he was just very fluid, and he could kind of go. He would sometimes play drums. He would sometimes play bass. He would sometimes play guitar. He was playing all the instruments, like piano on some tracks. I think I liked, you know, as a guy who was just coming straight out of music school, where you're like, oh, you should have a great ear. You should be able to hear everything you want to play before you play it and all this stuff. He just was not like that. He just tried stuff out and was willing to fall on his face until he found something he liked. Like, for example, there's one song he played this Gibson hollow body guitar on, and he took guitar solo for like 8 bars. And he just like played probably 12 or 15 takes in a row and just was like messing up and just like, yeah, how about, huh? But it was very, it wasn't like, here's a heavy musician guy, like, who's going to, like, blow your face off. But he was just creating these melodies and just trying to discover what was cool instead of having any preconceived things. And I don't, for some reason, that stands out to me as his willingness to just be out on the edge and find something new.
terrifying thing to do at any age, I would imagine. Mike, Gabe was saying that he started writing songs at a pretty early age. When did you start writing? Were you writing literature when you were at Harvard, or were you writing songs? When did writing become a part of your process?
Yeah, I was mostly a creative writer and writing short stories and poetry and stuff like that. And I didn't really transfer that over to music until I was probably in my 20s. And I realized I could kind of fuse the two.
Fair enough. Did you find it easier to write songs than you did short stories and prose and literature?
No, I didn't, because I wasn't necessarily super adept at the music part of it. So it was kind of figuring out how to link those two in myself. I was lucky to have a great songwriting partner in Paul Olson in my band Scrap-O-Matic, and he was just kind of endlessly creative. And he had a more of a track, probably like Gabe. He went to the University of Minnesota in the music performance school there. And so I was lucky enough to kind of be his Bernie Taupin in a way. Uh-huh. And kind of learn the craft in that manner.
Were there aspects of literary writing that you had to unlearn to become a good songwriter?
Yeah, I think so. Being super clever and verbose and showing off intellectually and stuff like that doesn't really pan out in music. And you also have to match what you're trying to say to the melody and to the chords. And so it's a very unique way of being creative. And it took me a while to kind of rearrange my brain.
You've worked with many songwriters, I believe, since then. Or do you notice that there's parts of your literary writing that you did take with you that make you different from your average songwriter that you meet?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, this ability to be economical and to kind of trust the process, not overthink it in a way. Also a real allegiance to image and as they say in all the writing classes, show, don't tell. That's been very helpful.
Now, Gabe, it sounded like Mike, almost through happenstance on the subway, met Derek Trucks and became part of his world. Like he said, he offered him a gig. When did you become a part of that orbit, and how did it happen?
Well, I was kind of a fan of the band for a while, Derek Trucks' band, and then Susan. Just coincidentally, my band ended up opening for Derek's band back in like 2002. Oh, wow. On probably just three or four or five shows. And then I think I met him briefly and then I was just kind of watching from afar, and I bought a couple records. And I think around 2016, people started telling me, they were like, have you ever worked with Derek Trucks and Susan Tedeschi in that band? And I was like, no, that would be amazing. You know, my friend David Ryan Harris, who I was on tour with in 2016, he was like, you got to do something with them. And Oliver Wood said the same thing around that time. And my bass player friend Ted Pecchio, I played one of my trio gigs with him one time. And he was like, hey, man, you really should meet Derek and Susan. And then not long after that, I got a call from Tyler Greenwell, Falcon, who's the drummer in the band, and he said, hey, our keyboard player Kofi Burbridge is sick, and we need somebody to sub for him for a couple of months till he gets better. And so you got recommended by a bunch of people. So would you be willing to learn 45 songs in a couple of weeks and start playing with us for a minute? And I was like, yeah, this will be the best. This will be the most fun 2 months.
Yeah.
You know, being a fan of the band. And, so that's kind of how I got involved. And then, you know, sadly, Kofi passed away a couple months after I started doing that. And, I thought, okay, well, I'll finish out this year and then go back to doing what I was doing as artist and writer and everything. But it just became clear that, after a while, they didn't just want like a Kofi Burbridge clone. They wanted whatever it was that I was bringing to the band. So that's why I'm still here, I guess. And I love the people and I love the music.
Tedeschi Trucks Band are one of our nation's foremost purveyors of blues music in the 21st century. They routinely play sold-out arenas. There's a poem that speaks to the humble beginnings of that legendary art form, though, by Michael Miller, entitled Blues Man. One century, which time let go, lives on stubbornly in this room. The speakers hum with tales of Sunday gospel, police dogs on the shoals, bootleg whiskey at the back of a bus in Chicago after the war. 30 chairs and a light turned low give shelter from the cold outside, where the word legend is scrawled in black by the photograph on the window. Hoarse, white-haired, he squints at the figures who watch him back from the crooked tables, his fingers conjuring the notes from childhood, his foot on the case tapping rhymes. "You're healed now," says the thin girl's eyes. "I'm out of change," says the man with the jar. A couple sways in the dark by the counter. The boy sits up front, eager, taking notes down. Their pens sustain him. At 10, alone, he walks by the ghosts of a college town. The bootleggers painted solemn on the gallery walls. Chicago beamed in the multiplex. The gnash of police dogs pantomimed through a flickering reel. The bus stopping by the curb to take him to his next one-night stand. The headlights gold as the waitress shuts out the light, unscarred, and heads for the dead of home. Now, a question for both of you. Both of you came from your own projects where you're kind of the captain of the ship creatively and the tone, the voice, the style of the project. Now you're both contributing to a project where you're contributing to a larger tone style. How do you navigate that as a creative? Is there a mental framework you have for either writing songs or writing parts for a Tedeschi Trucks Band record?
Well, I'll say this to take it back one notch. When Gabe came into the band, I was deeply and forever impressed by his ability not only to come in knowing all the material, but to kind of seamlessly put himself in there in a Kofi-like way. And you could hear Kofi elements, and he'd obviously digested everything Kofi had done, but it was still Gabe. You know, and that ability to be himself and yet be what was there, what needed to be there, and I think that's kind of what you have to have when you're in a big group like this. Is you have to think about, like, well, what are we? Whether we have those discussions, you know, out loud or not, you have to kind of be able to gauge, like, well, what's going on? What are we after? What are we trying to be? You know, inhabit the character as you see it, you know, and it's a weird task. It's easier said than done.
It felt natural to me to step in because I do have a lot of the same influences as Kofi music wise. You know, we all love like jazz and funk and blues and, you know, so I was excited to copy that stuff because I actually learned some stuff, you know, learned something just learning those parts. And but I did feel like there was a place where I could kind of add something to it. And I guess your question was sort of pointing toward how do we approach each project or how do we think of the band as a whole. And I feel like we kind of have what we have, you know, we kind of like all right, what have we got at our disposal here? We've got great playing. We've got, you know, Mike, who's an amazing songwriter and singer. And let's get together and, like, pool our resources and come up with the best thing that we possibly can. I feel like Derek and Susan are pretty good at sort of, curating and cultivating that, and sort of sourcing from the band members what they do well. If that makes any sense.
It does. I would imagine that you would write a song in different ways if you were writing a song for like a really good power trio, as opposed to writing a song for the 12 members that are in the Tedeschi Trucks band. Does writing for such a large band, is that an advantage that makes things easier, or does that make the writing process a thornier process?
I think it makes it easier in some ways, because there's, you're not necessarily going to come up with all the horn parts and everything when you're writing the song. You're not going to come up with all the like background vocals, but you can scale it according to what the song wants, you know, once you go in. So, and the process is different for every song. You know, sometimes it'll start with just Derek having a guitar idea, and then we'll, if it's me and Mike and Susan and Derek, we went to the farm in 2024 down in Georgia and had a camp out there. And so we took little ideas and worked through them. And then sometimes Mike will bring in like a full song, or I'll bring in a full song, and, you know, we'll take Leave It or a half song. Just, Falcon will do a cool demo and send it in. And it's kind of just, to me, feels out of left field. But when we play it out as a group, it's like, how does this work so well for this band? So I don't know. I feel like the process is it's a little, I don't know what the right word is for it, but kind of haphazard. And it's nice when we've put it through the filter of the music arranging and stuff, you know.
You mentioned kind of following the need of each particular song. How do you guys navigate the process? I'm sure what you meant by that on a certain level is addition by subtraction. You can't have all 12 people crashing in at once. How do you approach that arrangement phase where not everyone is while everyone is giving space for others to play? Is that something that happens naturally throughout the band, or is that something where someone who's kind of an MD or a producer has to carve those things out?
I think how it happens naturally in the band is if the initial spark or idea is yours, you're kind of assigned the curator of the song. So everybody gets input, but people kind of tend to defer to you if it's your idea. And in that way, everything's not just kind of watered down or by committee. There's a little bit of a guiding force in there. Do you think that's true, Gabe?
Absolutely, yeah. You come in with sometimes come in with really specific arranged demos that we just kind of will take and like augment a little bit and add, you know, and soup up with this or that. But like, it's got a nice structure to the arrangement. And that's actually really helpful, I think, sometimes, because I sort of did that with I Am the Moon, which was from the last record. Mm-hmm. You know, had a demo that was like, you know, with the acoustic guitar and, you know, hint, you know, instead of a whole drum set, it was a tambourine, you know, but like a general template for the band, I think, helps. Yeah. I would say that's true.
How do you strike the balance between not coming in with something that is too, that is so produced before the band gets there that no one feels like they have any room? How do you strike that balance?
I mean, I'm not that good of a producer, so.
an innate limitation.
I think a lot of it is a bit of a trust exercise too. I mean, like you're saying, Gabe, everybody's so good and for the most part tasteful. That you bring something in, it's like nobody's gonna take a hatchet to it. You know, people will understand where we're coming from because we do have we do share influences and stuff like that. And so if you're throwing around like, you know, I'm thinking this is like an Isley's thing or this is like a, you know, country blues thing, people get where you're coming from.
Talk to me about this new album that as we're recording this comes out tomorrow. It's called Future Soul. You guys worked very long and hard on this. You work with the producer Mike Elizondo. Had you guys worked with him before in the Tedeschi Trucks project?
I had not. I'd met him years ago back in the Derek Trucks band, maybe 20 years ago, and there was some talk about him doing some stuff with us, but it never panned out. And so when this came up again, we were all very enthusiastic about it.
What was his style as a producer like compared to previous projects you guys had done?
More of a disciplined process, I guess. Mm-hmm. The previous album, I've only been a part of two of the albums, but the first one was the previous album, I'm the Moon. It was very much, we'd show up at 11 or 12 to the studio, hang out, play, you know, off and on, eat dinner, party until like 2 or 3 in the morning sometimes, and we're still recording, and it's should we knock off? But Mike had a more, like, let's start, I can't remember, 10 or 11.
I think it was 10 a.m.
10 a.m. and we're done by dinner time, 5 or 6. And that was it. And it was, okay, office hours. And I'd say it worked really well. It was a lot more efficient. Working with him was nice. It was nice just to have an official producer who could yes or no an idea, or you know, if you're trying to make a decision, they're there with a thought, you know, and everyone kind of trusted him and sort of deferred to him, and that I think made things go quickly and more efficiently. What do you think, Mike?
Yes, streamlined is the word. It was nice, and I think the end product is a little more streamlined too. When we're on stage, the nice thing about this band is we can kind of follow where the music goes and take things improvisatory but I think we often don't capture what we do on stage on the record. And I think what Mike did really well is he just kind of like compressed it a little bit. He's like, look. Here, let's just do some 4-minute songs. And then, all the potential energy's in there and you can take them to the stage and do whatever you want with them.
I think that's wise. I think because recorded music and live music are such strangely different mediums. You would think that they would be more similar than they are, but the way that we experience as listeners a record on our own in our car versus with, 3,500 people at the Beacon Theater, 10 shows in a row. It's just completely different.
Yeah. I just can't tell you the number of times with my own band in the past that it was just like, people are like, wow, you just can't capture it on recording, man. It's just so different live. I really get it live. And I'm like, I don't understand why that is. maybe it's an energetic thing. I don't know. Like a physical proximity thing? I have no idea. But it is a strange phenomenon, I guess.
With all the work both of you guys have done in this project, how do you think you're different as a songwriter now? What do you think you've improved on as a songwriter working with this project over the years?
Personally, I've become more confident in my own songwriting voice from this band. You know, I spent a lot of years. I was like from about 2013 to 2017, 2018. I was writing on Music Row with all these. You know, I had somehow developed this idea that I wasn't a good songwriter, so I stopped trusting myself and just kind of was co-writing with everybody, which is great. I love co-writing. But, you know, I was very deferential at all times to every single writer I ever wrote with in a co-write. And I think that was, I think in this band, the fact that there were a couple of songs, like I never wrote by, I didn't even do much writing by myself for a whole 10 years, you know? And the fact that I brought in songs a couple times that I wrote 100% by myself and this band liked them and put them on the record, you know, I think it's helped my confidence as a writer. That's what I had to say about that, which has been great for me because it makes me want to write more. You know?
How about you, Mike? What's changed?
I think I had to teach myself how to write, I guess, I don't know how I'd say it, to spec or something like that. Like I came from a place where I was writing kind of with myself or my partner, Paul, and for us in a very specific voice. And I had to kind of get out of my own head and really consider where other people were coming from and grow up a little bit that way in terms of a songwriter take inputs and learn how to collaborate.
Well, luckily, a background in literary fiction probably helps you write for characters. Gentlemen, today's a show day for you, so I'm going to let you go. I'm going to let you go back to the drudgery of playing 10 shows at the Beacon Theater in New York City. It's been an absolute honor and a pleasure to have you on The Working Songwriter. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you, Joe. Take care.
This week's show was brought to you by Bandzoogle. Built by musicians and for musicians, Bandzoogle is an all-in-one platform to build a beautiful website for your music. Use promo code TWS, the initials of our podcast, TWS, to get 15% off the first year of any new subscription. The Tedeschi Trucks Band's latest album is entitled Future Soul, available everywhere music is sold or streamed. If before we meet again, you sit down to write, please remember, an expensive drug habit is not a song, a compelling Instagram account is not a song, and most importantly, reverb is not a song. So let all that take care of itself, and for you, just keep your eye on the song.